I'm Candy Shannon, and you are tuned to Member Supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to 89.3 FM, WPFW, your Pacifica Foundation radio station, out of Washington, D.C., 50,000 watts strong, 46 years in existence due to you, the listener, supporting this community-based progressive jazz and justice radio station. My name is David Whetstone. The hour is We the People. I'm happy to have you join us. This morning, we're going to have a discussion with Sophia Warren, who's been a contributing cartoonist to the New Yorker since 2017. Her work has been featured in MoMA magazine, MoMA as in Museum of Modern Art, Narrative magazine, Catapult, and the books Notes from the Bathroom Line and Send Help. She is a visiting professor at Wesleyan University and is based in Brooklyn. Using the graphic memoir format, her book is the subject of our conversation, Radical, My Year with a Socialist Senator. It's a remarkable firsthand account of her experience embedded with New York State Senator Julia Salazar and her staff during her first year in office. From the candid conversations and eyewitness experiences, Ms. Warren builds a gripping and intimate portrait of a scrappy team of community organizers battling entrenched power structures, particularly to advance Ms. Salazar's marquee issue of housing rights. Good morning, Ms. Warren.
Hi. And thank you so much
Sophia,
for having me.
If you please.
And you can.
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, David? Thanks for having me.
Oh, pretty good. And I'm going to hold off a question that I often ask guests, which is how have they managed with the pandemic? Because it is part of our story. And to give people a good idea of that story, I'll just say this as by way of an introduction. Is politics, the political process, truly responsive to people? What makes a good leader? What does it mean to be part of a community? And can democracy work? How can everyday people make change happen? You address all those concerns in this wonderful memoir, and we're on the radio. It's an audio or oral media, but I wanted to give people, they can hear it in my voice already, a sense of excitement. It's in a graphic format. Some of our younger listeners may be used to the concept of a graphic novel which is a pictorial but strong depiction of story in a relatively new format. It's certainly historical. The idea of illustrations have been with us for a long time, but I think this graphic memoir and the graphic novel, it does something extra. We really live in a privileged age. So that being said, I insinuated by my questions in the introduction that the average everyday person knows that the politics is out there, probably in some state capital or a national capital or some distant capital around the world. And you cannot blame that person for feeling like the practice of politics, the exercise of politics, really doesn't affect everyday life. But you had something different. And I'm wondering how New York State politics, and in particular, Julia Salazar, caught your attention and engaged you.
Yeah. The origin of this story is that it was 2018, so 2 years into the Trump presidency. I was, needless to say, not a fan of that administration. And just as you've said about politics feeling really distant and removed, I certainly was feeling that. I was someone who would donate and occasionally go to protests and read the newspaper every day, but it was not feeling like a meaningful engagement with politics. And the result of that is that I was feeling really quite helpless. You know, the things that were happening out of Washington and on a global scale felt entirely beyond my control, and distant and abstract. Meanwhile, I was living in North Brooklyn. I technically was living in Ridgewood, which is in Queens, but the neighborhood now, actually, because of redistricting, is part of the same district as Bushwick. At the time, it was separate. But anyway, my neighborhood that I spent all my time in was Bushwick, which is in North Brooklyn. And in 2018, there was this incredibly visible race going on for state Senate, specifically for candidate Julia Salazar, who is someone I did not know, but there was so much energy around it. It was a tremendous grassroots effort, especially in that summer. I really could not walk from the 10 minutes from where I lived to where I worked without bumping into multiple canvassers on street corners in a park. There were pictures of her in every bodega. It really felt like something new and like something very exciting. And this is a person who was my age. She was 27 at the time, and was running on this really bold platform of housing rights, of being a democratic socialist, and running against a democratic incumbent who had been in office for many, many years, who was quite entrenched. None of this is anything that I had ever paid attention to before. Did not know anything about state politics. I didn't know who my representative was. I didn't know how long a term was. I didn't really know what they did. But I became really intrigued as a result of this specific campaign and because of specifically Julia Salazar. So when she won that primary race, my thought was, this is a person who feels close to me in a way that other politicians haven't. This is something that I feel an immediacy. And I love comics. I could talk about them forever. I think one of the things that I love about having this be the medium that I work in is that it gives me an opportunity or an excuse to go places that I might not feel comfortable, you know, to go to events and draw. It kind of gives me an anchor and a purpose. And so my thought was, I really want to know more about politics. I want to feel more engaged. I want to learn from these people about, you know, what is it about this 27-year-old that made her run for office and win? And what's the difference between her and me? And how can I get some of that? So there was this selfish angle for me to just try and I wanted to spend time here. It felt like drawing this comic would be a good way for me to do it. So I sent them an email and I said, would you be open to me following you around? I think it could be a really cool way to learn about government and to make it into a book. And to my surprise, there was absolutely no resistance at any point. People were very excited about the project. They understood, I think, what I was going for. So it was pretty seamless. And once we made contact, it just kind of went from there.
So you're entering a space or a place and a group of people that extend goodwill and camaraderie right away. That will become apparent to any reader of Radical, My Year with a Socialist Senator. And it's a bold idea to do the embedding thing. So is it okay to kind of approach you in this conversation that you're not only a cartoonist and animator, so to speak, but you're also a reporter? And, you know, it's a very humanistic story. I mean, you affirm Ms. Salazar's humanity, the people around her, the communities that you and she are in. And that is well and good. But I want to also lift up some of the excellence that I detected in the graphic memoir, which is there's a journalistic practice. So that leads me to ask you this as slyly as I can. We often engage politics, and we usually are the voices in our head and heart. The sub-vocalization is either we're combating cynicism or we're trying to maintain like a hopeful optimism, particularly since we've decided to spend time in the political process. Where did you find yourself as you're undertaking this story? I mean, it's certainly bold to say, hey, I want to accompany you. What kind of framework, what kind of mindset did you have in doing this, or at least initially start with?
Generally speaking, I was incredibly disillusioned with politics. It's not something that I had ever been. I've never been, you know, a wonk or someone who loves politics. It's something that I felt was important, but in 2018. I was feeling very skeptical of politics. And the course of this story, as you mentioned, and thank you for what you've said about the humanity of it. That was entirely my intent, was I thought, how do I make this feel personal for me? And I hope feel personal for people who are reading this book. And for me, that meant embedding with folks and really getting to know the people behind this one state office. I'm very lucky that this office was one whose philosophy politically was of great transparency. So they completely understood my project. And that included maintaining my creative control. No one in that office ever asked to oversee anything. I got just absolutely complete understanding from them that I should be an independent voice here, but also that meant that I was in the room for quite a lot of, you know, tension and discomfort and stress and arguments. And that all was important to show me, even if it didn't necessarily look flattering in every moment. The result of that for me is that, and I hope that this comes through in the book and in the narrative, is that I felt great hope over the course of this year. I mean, these were, I don't think all politicians are good. I don't think that we should give them a carte blanche, but this particular group of people who came with a really strong sense of accountability to their constituents and to their people, who ran on a campaign of taking no special interest money, and being pretty uncompromising with these things, it was really moving for me to see that and to see it also be effective. This was a year when there was Democratic control for the first time in quite a long time in the Senate in New York and in the Assembly of New York and the governorship. So it meant that there was this real opportunity to actually pass legislation in a way that it had been stymied in many years prior. So it was this very active year for the Democrats in New York, which was very moving in and of itself. And then to see specifically an office that maintained such a connection to the principle of people power and of working with organizers and with movements, to see that channel into the legislature, I found incredibly inspiring. And I'll just to jump forward in time to now for a minute. I mean, this is another moment when I personally feel quite overwhelmed by the politics in the US writ large. And the one thing that feels sustaining to me is that I have an understanding of what tools are at our disposal as people, as everyday people, like what we can do. All of that is something that I learned over the course of this process of the book, and that the book is really about. So yes, came to it, to answer your question, came to it quite cynical. And it is not to say that I have thrown that out the window, but I have great appreciation and a hope that I think is realistic, but motivating, having been in this office for a year.
Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and the wonderful narration and reflection that you're hearing is from Sophia Warren. Ms. Warren has been a contributing cartoonist to The New Yorker since 2017, and we're discussing her graphic memoir, Radical, My Year with a Socialist Senator. Ms. Warren, again, pleasure to have you with us. So we're going to do a deliberate annotation, a sort of pause, so to speak. You're entering a political campaign and a process and the eventual election of a state senator, Julia Salazar. We mentioned that in New York State, the Democrats for a long time control all three branches of the executive with the governor and the two branches, and the state legislature, both the assembly and the Senate. And I don't think that's happened. You know, people at the rest of the country look at New Yorkers and typify us as characterized by New York City and the five boroughs, and that we're liberal and we're progressive and we're majority Democratic. And that's not a characteristic of this big, beautiful state, which has rural areas, industrial areas, other major cities. The capital's in Albany, 3 going on to 4 hours north of New York. And again, I want to just swing back and loop and say, so the Democrats have not been in total control of government and governance since 1912. This is 2018. Is that it's a banner year?
There were a handful of years within that span of about a decade, but the vast majority of that time, it had not been. And this was the largest majority that they'd seen in that long. So it was a pretty momentous year.
And on the Senate side, a fresh grouping of new senators as well, which is important. But yes. I interrupted the flow. What I was going to say is, and the title reveals that Ms. Salazar is a socialist, and one of her, I wouldn't even say constituents, but her supporters are from the Democratic Socialists of America. So the S word is not a dreaded word for this station, but for anyone who's new and listening, let's talk about the socialism you encountered. You've already talked about the characteristics of transparency, a process of openness, of welcoming, of really being accountable. Tell us a little bit about, naively put, what you understand of the socialism that you encountered both in the elected official, but also in the group of people around her.
Yeah, it's the Democratic Socialists of America. I'll just say, it's an organization that is distinct from being a democratic socialist. You can be a democratic socialist and not be a member or not be active in the DSA. That said, in New York in particular, that group has been quite effective and continues to be quite effective in electoral politics as far as endorsing candidates and then supporting them throughout their races. Julia was the first state legislator, to be a socialist openly in the legislature in, as far as I can tell, about 100 years. There was a kind of contentious period in during the Red Scare when a number of socialists were expelled from the legislature. Interesting history, but I won't get into it.
You're welcome to do so if you like, by the way.
It is pretty fascinating. There's this group of five assemblymen from Brooklyn who are in a Republican majority assembly in 1919 or 1920, I think. And all five of them are expelled for disloyalty to the United States and New York is the charge. Then and a number of them are reelected, and then they're expelled again, and then a few resign in protest, and some are elected a third time. So there's this drama around it. But anyway, so it's been 100 years since that's been a visible force in the legislature. As far as what that fundamentally meant in the office, it was interesting to see because primarily it was not in the day-to-day workings of the office. What it meant was certain tenets of, as I said, transparency, of belief in empowering constituents and serving constituents over moneyed interests. It meant a belief in this office. There were a number of people coming from a background in organizing, and so which ties in to their socialism. It meant that there was an emphasis on collective action, on building power through. So for example, some of the staff spent time working with in the district with folks around issues of, say, education, just to build community and to facilitate conversations. That's something that they really emphasized, whether or not it was directly related to legislation that was coming up that year. It might be something that they referred to as deep organizing, meaning creating these connections that go beyond whether or not this office is in control of the district, of the state senate in the district. So I was also very curious, because she was the first socialist and because it had been such a flashpoint during the campaign, how that was going to affect her ability to work with the Democrats, because, you know, socialist is not a separate party. It is, she was elected as a Democrat working with that conference. As you mentioned,
Just let me ask, did the media or other parties slam her because of her socialist identity? I'm not clear on that altogether.
The campaign was quite bruising, I would say. There was a lot, especially after, typically state Senate races, especially someone like Julia, who's coming from a background outside of politics, a grassroots campaign, running against someone who was so entrenched. Her incumbent had been there for many terms at that point. It's not typically the kind of thing that gets a ton of media attention, but immediately before her primary in June, this is when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has her big upset victory. And suddenly there is a ton of attention on Julia because she is also a DSA endorsed Democratic Socialist Latina running in New York, right? A lot of parallels. And so it did, I think, very much affect the level of attention and the level of critique in that campaign. That said, so I'm going into it with that understanding that this is going to be something that'll be contentious. And I have to say that I did not see, and it was not communicated to me, that that was something that particularly affected her relationships in the legislature once she started actually doing her job.
We're talking to Sophia Warren, and we're talking about her graphic memoir, Radical, My Year with a Socialist Senator. It's about the starting point of a New York State Senator, Julia Salazar. And you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We're entirely listener supported. We're public broadcasting, but we're community based. And our theme throughout our 46-year existence, sustained by listeners, is being jazz and justice. We seek to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. There are over 100 programmers that diligently apply themselves to this purpose. Ms. Warren, again, thank you for being with us. In a matter of moments, we're coming up on a break, but I want to give people a sense of a sneak preview. The marquee issue or concern, the mainstay of Ms. Salazar, State Senator Salazar, is housing. In the next minute or two, can you at least give us a preliminary picture of why housing is such an important concern for New York State, beyond even New York City? Thank you.
Yes. This is a state where real estate is a tremendous, the real estate industry is a tremendous force in politics, a huge amount of money going back and forth. Development is a big part of the economy in New York. And it's a place where there are more tenants than any other state, at least there were in 2019. I believe that's still the case.
About 40% of the residents in New York State are renters of some sort.
I think it's a little higher than 40, but it's two-thirds of the city and quite high across the state. So rents are, just to keep it brief, rents are constantly a point of conflict, and tenants represent a very large block of constituents in New York, and rents continue to go up as they do across the country. Certainly now it's a very much in the eye of everyone across the country, but it was also a very big issue in 2019 in New York. And it was a big year for tenant organizing, which is a big part of the narrative in my book.
All right. And on that note, we're going to take a brief break, do our due diligence, and we'll have public service announcements. Listeners, won't you stay with us? And we'll be right back in a few moments. You're listening to We the People on WPFW 89.3 FM.
From August 3rd through the 16th, during our summer pledge drive, we present WPFW, 48 years of centering Blackness. We'll commemorate Black August and celebrate not only the freedom fighters, political prisoners, and those who have perished in the struggle for Black liberation, but also the scholars, musicians, and poets whose work has served the Black liberation struggle. There are forces working to erase the contributions and significance of Black people. Your contribution ensures that WPFW is not erased and that the voices of Black people throughout the diaspora continue to be platformed here. Donations can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, we've been talking about the whole notion of culture, its preservation, its maintenance, its sustainability, and how culture sustains us. We've been doing that with James Counts Early, the former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. Not his claim, but my way of describing him to you would be that Mr. Early is sort of a cultural activist, advocate, curator. And I think it's just, that it's marvelous that we just have you in this hour, Mr. Early, just to be frank with you. Your last remarks before our break have many extensions, many insinuations. I think in our best of days, what we want to do with culture is to recognize it, respect it, acknowledge it, value it, encourage it, empower it, and celebrate it. And that's not an abstraction. That's about people dealing and living with people. We ended on some of the challenges that surround the notion of culture. We definitely have made reference to cross-generational things. I appreciate in your answer that it's our duty to convey those things of culture. Often people think of maintaining and locking in place tradition or some set ideology. But I think it's upon reflection, I think most people would sensitively say it's trying to preserve community, it's trying to affirm our humanity. And you were quite insistent, and rightly so, that culture changes over time and ought to. My question to you then is, we want to accentuate the positive, but we're in a terrible time where people are actively trying to destroy cultures. Particularly, these people are not in the political majority, or they're in a numerical minority, or they're marginalized, or they've already been pre-victimized. Can you just talk a little bit about your observations? You're very well traveled across this globe. How people deal and preserve and enrich culture to the benefit of all?
Well, let's start with really a urgent issue in the nation's capital of the United States of America, which is the political capital, that is the governance capital of 300 and some odd million people, and the attacks on the Smithsonian Institution, whose simple but profound mandate is the increase in diffusion of knowledge among men, unquote, was its initial vantage point. Which is now, because of the nature, the political nature of culture, of women fighting along with men allies to recognize the socialization of women is not characterized essentially by their biology, but how they have been positioned in the sociology of power, if you will, that we now talk about the increase in diffusion of knowledge among many different expressions of Homo sapiens who are of different cultures and different languages and different religions. So the attack on the Smithsonian Institution, I think it's quite instructive that the front door of that attack is on the African American, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and its founding director. Dr. Lonnie Bunch, who is former chief curator of the National Museum of American History, and because American history historically, that museum was Eurocentric in its orientation, male dominance in its orientation, and not inclusive as it should be of the various other cultural expressions indicated by indigeneity and racial and ethnic backgrounds, Latinos, women, etc., then it gave rise to a political movement, a governance movement, a self-determined movement of me too. Here is my socialized way of being, and it is rich and complex enough that a museum, actually several museums, could be sustained on that. So that the frontal attack on the Smithsonian Institution is highly racialized. And that there is a movement to protect the emergence of the National Museum of American History and Culture, which dates back to the Civil War of Black soldiers involved saying, we want to be recognized in a museum. And it's gone through various proposals over the years. But that front door attack, racialized attack, is going horizontal. It's going against the proposal of a new women's museum there, of a Latino museum there, led by right-wing Cubans who are on the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian, the policy-making platform of the Smithsonian, to stand to bring their essentialized view of what Latinos should be. I think we have to then understand the power of culture, the politics of culture in that regard. There is a movement of a white supremacist, Eurocentric, male Christian orientation as the official ways of knowing and behavior in the United States, which might be accepting in secondary and tertiary elements of other historically evolved cultures, which involves people, Black people, Latinos, gay and lesbian people who are also supporting this white supremacist Eurocentric view. This is the complexity of culture, and it's a cautionary tale against over-centralizing. There is the cultural...
Again, and just since we're in the second half of the show, essentializing being you particularize a standard and you say that standard's above all others. Is that a...
That standard above all others, and that if you are of a particular group, this is how you should think and...
It's normative. It's controlling.
And comport yourself or carry yourself. And therein, if you don't do it in the way that is pronounced, you are a traitor. As though there is some inherent predetermined, naturalized expression that because of the color of your skin or your gender or your sexual preference, this is how you should act. There is a danger in that, because even in among oppressed and exploited groups, with that kind of characterizing, a centralizing that this is what it means to be male, or this is what it means to be female, or what it means to be Black, those are very dangerous constructions that limit the imagination of the individual, because it all redounds to what, who are the individuals in a group. Things don't change unless new imaginative perspectives come forward. They don't come through, these imaginative perspectives don't come forward by consensus voting. It comes through the power of the individualized voice who amalgamates other interests, other affinities.
So the individual to the collective.
Breaks through. Yes. June Jordan is breaks not to through. Be conflated with every Black writer of her generation. She is a distinct voice. And while she and Alice Walker may have many convergences, Nikki Giovanni may have many convergences, within that grouping, these are highly individualized voices. Mary Baraka and A.B. Spellman. A.B. Spellman in his 90s in Washington, D.C., who brings us a avant-garde jazz critique in Four Lives in the Bebop World, is an individual voice. He is not to be conflated with his classmate, Mary Baraka, notwithstanding the various intersections and the impact that he says Mary Baraka had on him. They are yet distinct voices. So these are things in the preservation and in the moment. These are not abstract questions. There is an attempt to erase these democratic expressions. That is demos, we the people, crasha, the power of different historically evolved perspectives to be a part of a mainstream official culture. There is an attempt to erase that, book burning. Lies that are turning narratives that slaves were happy and it's better to have been enslaved than to have remained on the continent of Africa.
With the added also annotation that they didn't know anything, that they didn't do anything, and they needed the training, which is just so terribly offensive.
Right, which
face.
Then attempts to attack that the crucible of American democracy, that is the test case. Just simply look at the legal entities, the challenge of these descendants of enslaved Africans to make the Constitution actually reflective of the way that the society should work against how it was working, set precedent for other exploited and discriminated groups, including upper class white women who were not property owners, who were subservient to a male perspective of the way that the world should work, a male perspective of what is good, truth, and beautiful as foundational elements of one's being. And so that we are in that attempt now to resegregate America and to diminish these other voices and to actually turn the children of those heroic fighters into expressions of Eurocentrism. Everything Europe produced is not bad. But to say that that is the apex of cultural expression, then is to try to eradicate the different ways of knowing and doing that we have historically expressed and fought to be a part of official designation of what is good, truth, and beautiful, who are acceptable human beings, and what is virtue. And so that we are in under a huge attack, because if you can name the world, then you can claim it. But if someone names it for you, then you are subservient to their vantage point. So the attack on the economy is in concert with the attack on ways of knowing and doing, as expressed in the Library of Congress, as expressed in the Smithsonian Institution. Notwithstanding contradictions in both of those institutions, we have fought not just to be a part of it, but we have fought to transform them. And we have transformed the curriculum throughout. This is where Black Studies, again, is the crucible, a test case that opened up the avenue for other centric expressions, Latino-Chicano studies, women's studies, the second iteration of the women's movement was empowered and energized by the civil rights movement. And so these are urgent matters, not just esoteric or academic discursive matters to talk about. They really strike at the heart of our very being and self-identity.
The voice that you're hearing, the comments that you're hearing are from James Counts Early. We're talking about culture right here on We the People, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, in existence for more than 48 years because you or listeners like you choose to give us social and financial support that has kept that long tenure going, and I thank you for that. There are plenty of good reasons to listen to WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station. For instance, on this day, at 3 o'clock, Sophie's Parlor, done by one of the oldest established women's collectives on public broadcasting. Music and culture by women before everyone. At 2 o'clock, Zen El Amin, Shea Wanana, talks about Middle Eastern